All right, good morning, everybody. It's been a little bit, and so we'll just review a tiny bit here. And so we left off in Genesis 18, and we said that Genesis, I point out the fact that Genesis has an interesting word that helps us break the book up into sections. And I noted that there were 10 different toldits, and toldit means this is what became of. And so we were kind of working our way through these toldits and finding out, okay, this is what became of heaven and earth, Adam, and we traced Adam from, you know, in Cain's line to Seth and Adam's line to Noah. And so we were in the sixth one where we were taking a look at Abraham, so and how he went from Abram to Abraham. And you'll remember that back in chapter 12, the beginning of the Abrahamic covenant, and what did God promise? He said, you know, get out. And out was an imperative. Get out from your land, get out from your kindred, from your house, to the land I'll show you. And God will make him a great nation. God will bless him. And God will make his name great, not just because he's a really cool guy, but that God will make his name great, that he would be a blessing. And he would bless those around him. God would curse those that curse him. And that by him, through him, God would bless the entire families of the world. And so we were taking a look at Abram's life, and we also need to pause here for a second. So Genesis is a bunch of oral stories that were shared with who? The very first audience that got to hear Genesis specifically was X's generation. So the children of Israel, they're out of Egypt, but do they really have a long-term experience with God? All of them but their leader are under 40. And yeah, all their parents are dying off throughout the 40 years. And they're learning about God. And we said that oftentimes these short narrations, we think of narration as the history and the telling. But in Genesis, the focus was on God, and we get to see what God has going on. Some of the stylistic things, there were short sentences, little familiar words. I've tried to point out some of the words that keep repeating, and that's because, again, if these are oral tradition, oral stories that are being told to everybody, hey, they had short attention spans just like we do, and the repetition drives home the point. They had vivid word pictures. There's interesting direct quotes. And so just like in service, Bob's been kind of drawing attention to the fact that, hey, the style of writing, the way it was written, we get this little tidbit, but then we want to know more about what's going on here. But no, this is the tidbit that we get for this story. Well, so that helps us focus in on what's the point. Because sometimes, I don't know about you, but sometimes we tend to read stories and we focus just on the action, what's going on. And so again, today in Genesis 18, I want to take a look at what's written, but I want us to kind of focus on maybe some stuff that hopefully you guys all know this and this is pure review, but maybe you haven't looked at it this way, and we'll go ahead and take a look at that. So go ahead, turn to Genesis 18. Normally, lots of times we go ahead and cheat all us long-term church people, look at the chapter titles in our Bible and go, okay, yeah, all right, I know what this is. I remember this story, and I remember the flannel graph from from what was going on. Come on. A lot of us know what flannel graphs are. I know some of you don't, but a lot of us remember flannel graphs, and they were fun. So chapter 18, and we're going to jump in at the second half of the chapter, but that means that we got to at least catch up on what the heck was going on in the first part, because the first part definitely ties in. Three people came and appeared to Abram and Sarah. One was the Lord, and two were angels with him. And in 17, he just reviewed and expanded on the Abrahamic covenant. You can go home and read that. And man, that was fantastic. So we're going to pick up at 18, verse 16. And just to be difficult, sometimes I go ahead and I read the NET translation. And so if you want to follow along with me, I went ahead and put it up here. And so let's go ahead and just read the first little bit. When the men got up to leave, so that's the angel, the two angels, and the Lord. When the men got up to leave, they looked out over Sodom. Narration comment. Now, Abram was walking with them to see them on their way. Then the Lord said, "Shall I hide what I'm about to do? After all, Abraham will surely become a great and powerful nation, and all the earth will pronounce blessings on one another using his name. I have chosen him so that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing what is right and just. Then the Lord will give Abraham all that he spoke to him." The Lord is talking to the two angels, and Abraham's maybe listening, or maybe just, you know, kind of following back a little bit, maybe trying to catch up with them. They're heading out, and the Lord says, "Do I tell Abraham what's about to happen?" Well, he's come down to earth, and he's talked to him, and questioning whether he's gonna about to tell Abraham what. Those of you that can, you know, look at the chapter title, what's about to happen? Destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. So, yeah, do I tell him? Well, why did he say he was gonna tell him? Because the Lord just spells it out for us right there. Why is he gonna tell him? So God already promised that he was going to make Abram a great nation and that Abram was going to bless all these nations of the world. And then what else? What's another reason why he's going to go ahead and explain this to Abraham? What does it say? By doing what is right and just, keep the way of the Lord. And who is he explaining this to? I have chosen him so that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord. And who's Abraham supposed to explain this to? His children and his children's children and even you and I. The Lord's spelling out here, you know what? I'm going to tell them and I'm going to explain it so that they can understand why I'm doing this. It's for righteous to walk rightly and justly. The Lord explains to the angels why he's going to tell Abraham what's about to happen. And he tells them so that he can tell his kids to go ahead and explain to them, do what is right and just, and then I'll bless you. One huge object lesson. What an object lesson. Wow. Now, he doesn't want Abram to miss this point. Follow the Lord and do what is right and just. And by doing what is right and just, you're following the Lord. It's real clear. You tell your kids, what does it mean to follow the Lord? By doing what is right and just. Make no mistake. And you know what? these folks. What about the folks in front? All right. So let's pick up in verse 20. So the Lord said, the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is so great, their sin is so blatant, that I must go down and see if they are as wicked as the outcry suggests. If not, I will know. Okay, first off, the Lord's going to go down and see. It's the same word of go down and see that we saw back at the Tower of Babel. Does the Lord need to go down and see? Did God need to go? And when we looked at the Tower of Babel, God said, we'll go down and see this tower that's reaching up to us. Yeah. It was partly a joke and a pun, making fun of, yeah, the tower's so tall, I got to go down and see it. But the same word here is used, you know what, I'm going to go down and see. Not to inform God, but to communicate to Abraham that he's not just, you know what, I don't like Sodom and Gomorrah, flick, they're gone. No, I'm going to go down and see. I've heard that their wickedness is so great, I'm going to wipe them out. Wait, but I mean, he announced he was going to do a global flood, and then the next day he killed everybody, right? 120 years later, you got a huge, back then you had a huge object lesson of some crazy dude building a huge boat in the middle of nothingness that doesn't make any sense. And he preached the whole time and shared with them. So, yeah, God doesn't just play whack-a-mole. God doesn't. God is so patient. And even here, God's loving, and he's going down and seeing. And Christ was here before he even ministered for how many years? 30 years working as a carpenter. And then he had 3 years of ministry where he talked and shared with people. And they didn't get it, and they didn't get it, and they didn't get it. So, yeah, God is patient. God wants us to get it. Let's move on a little bit here. So, in verse 22, the two men turned and headed toward Sodom. But Abraham was still standing before the Lord. Abraham approached and said, will you sweep away the godly along with the wicked? What if there are 50 godly people in the city? Will he really wipe it out and not spare the place for the sake of the 50 godly people who are in it? Far be it from you to do such a thing, to kill the godly with the wicked, treating the godly and the wicked alike. Far be it from you. Will not the judge of the whole earth do what is right? I'm not sure what chapter titles you have, or section titles you have in your Bible, but as soon as, you know, I say, Abraham brings up, will you spare the city for 50? How many of us immediately kind of jump to the whole rest of the story? We know, okay, so what's Abraham going to do? He asks about 50, and then he's going to ask about 45, and then 40, and 30, and 20. What about 10? And I've heard a lot of sermons that say, you know, this is a wonderful example of intercessory prayer. I mean, okay, Abraham did try to intercede on behalf of the city. Yes, that is true. But is it his focus for intercessory prayer? What was Abraham's motivation? Yeah, that's what it says. Now, I heard somebody say Lot. He's got family down there. But we're going to read through this, and I challenge you, does he ever bring up Lot? He never says Lot's name, and I'm suggesting to you that that wasn't his at least primary motivation, and it certainly isn't his described motivation in here. He's spelling out, this is an object lesson to the world, and are you really going to sweep away the godly with the wicked? Are you just, like you're telling me to teach my kids? Are you just? Well, let's take a look. So the Lord replied, if I find in the city of Sodom 50 godly people, I will spare the whole place for their sake. Then Abraham asked, since I have undertaken to speak to the Lord, although I'm but dust and ashes, what if there's five less than 50 people? Will you destroy the whole city because five are lacking? He replied, I will not destroy if I find 45 there. Abraham spoke to him again, what if 40 are found there? He replied, I will not do it for the sake of 40. Then Abraham said, may the Lord not be angry so that I may speak. What if 30 are found there? He replied, I will not do it if I find 30 there. Abraham said, since I have undertaken to speak to the Lord, what if only 20 are found there? He replied, I will not destroy it for the sake of 20. Finally, Abraham said, may the Lord not be angry so that I may speak just once more. What if 10 are found there? He replied, I will not destroy it for the sake of 10. The Lord went on his way when he had finished speaking to Abraham. Then Abraham returned home. Again, God, are you willing to spare the wicked for the righteous? And are you just? Okay, so what's the point? I'm suggesting that the point of this, the primary focus of this passage, isn't Abraham praying an intercessory prayer for his relative. It's about the character of God. What is the way of the Lord? He's supposed to teach the way of the Lord to his children. What is the way of the Lord? That you live righteous and a just life, right? And so rather than saying, you know, what do we learn about Sodom? I think this passage is really, what do we learn about God? And the major point, I think, here is that the people, and it was originally given to the Israelites, but yeah, it's also, it is instruction for us, but we first always want to take a look at what they understood it before we start trying to apply it to ourselves. But the people can be confident that God will not destroy the righteous with the wicked, but that when God judges, he's just. He didn't just leave it to, yeah, I've heard from other folks. No. He sent angels to go check it out. So.
And he had the way of saving righteous Lot. I mean, one person, one out of the ten, but he had the way of saving the righteous either.
Yes. Yep. And so we actually have some time to take a look at that. And so we're going to take a look at 19. So chapter 19 talks about what happened. I don't know that we're going to get through it all, but we're going to take a look at 19 and see what happened. So now, Lot, before we get there, and we've already mentioned him, who is Lot? Abraham's nephew. And back in Genesis 13, Abraham and Lot split up. Anybody remember how come besides Fred? I love you, buddy.
Well, they were getting too much stuff. And they wanted to herds and stuff.
How are they getting so much stuff? God's blessing them. God's blessing them so much the land won't support it. And so Lot, his nephew, who actually came along on this journey, was being blessed as well. There's so much stuff. And Abraham said, hey, you know what? We need to part because the land won't support it. So he let Lot go first and said, you pick wherever you want. And where did he pick to go? And somebody look up 13:12. And where did Lot choose to go? I know you know it. Did he immediately go into Sodom? What does 13:12 say? As far as Sodom. Yep. Another translation says he pitched his tent near Sodom. As far as Sodom.
Verse 10 says that he noticed that it was all well watered, and this was before the Lord obliterated Sodom and Gomorrah. It was like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt, all the way to Zoar.
So Lot sees the prime land and goes, I'm going there. And he goes and he pitches his tent near Sodom. In chapter 14, a bunch of kings get together, like kings do, and there's a fight down in the valley between five local warlords and four local warlords. And does anybody remember what Abraham did in chapter 14? What was that?
He went and kicked their butt.
Yes, and he rescued Lot. And so this is the nephew that he went and rescued. And so at first he pitched his tent near Sodom, and then he gets rescued. It's the same Lot that Abram and his men rescued from the warlords in chapter 14. So let's take a look at what happened now in 19. The two angels came to Sodom in the evening while Lot was sitting in the city gateway. When Lot saw them, he got up to meet them and bowed down with his face toward the ground. He said, "Hear, my lords, please turn aside to your servant's house. Stay the night, wash your feet, then you can be on your way in the morning." "No," they replied, "we'll spend the night in the town square." So lots of times when we've been looking at these narrations, and I've even mentioned cue ominous music, right in the very beginning of a new section, we find out what's going to be the problem, what's going to be the danger. And where do we find Lot right now? We find them at the city gates. So normally business is conducted at the city gates. And so Lot used to be just a dude camped near it. And now he's maybe some sort of official or at least a businessman, an important guy. And he's at the city gates. And I will mention in verse 3, there's this word that, we didn't read that yet. So let's read that now. But I'll just tell you, but he urged them persistently. He pressed hard on them. So they turned aside with him and entered his house. He prepared a feast for them, including bread baked without yeast, and they ate. Before they could lie down to sleep, all the men, both young and old, from every part of the city of Sodom surrounded the house. How much of the city is included in this? All of them. They shouted to Lot, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us so that we can have sex with them." Lot went outside to them, shutting the door behind him. He said, "No, my brothers, don't act so wickedly." No, my brothers. Lot identifies with them. Now, maybe it's just in his speech, but I think Lot already identifies with Sodom. "No, my brothers, don't act so wickedly. Look, I have two daughters who have never had sexual relations with a man. Let me bring them out to you, and you can do to them whatever you please." And the "whatever you please" in the Hebrew would really be translated to them what is good in your eyes. Does that also sound familiar? Relating to wickedness that we've seen in the past? Verse 9. "Out of our way," they cried, "and this man came to live here as a foreigner, and now he dares to judge us. We'll do more harm to you than to them." They kept pressing in on Lot until they were close enough to break the door. That same word, pressing, again, in these stories we see this wordplay. Lot pressed on the two angels. He urged them. He pressed hard on them. "You got to come to my place." And now, the same word, pressed. They pressed on Lot so hard, yelling at him that they're going to do worse to him. And they're, where are they? They are literally right at the door. Right at the door of Lot's house. They're surrounding his whole house. Verse 10. "So the men inside reached out and pulled Lot back into the house as they shut the door. Then they struck the men who were at the door of the house, from the youngest to the oldest, with blindness. The men outside wore themselves out trying to find the door." They're all trying to attack these two guys. They're struck with blindness, the entire town. And what do they keep doing? They're committed to what they're going to do. They don't even care that they're blind. They're committed to their path, and they're going to keep at it. If there's any question as to, you know, how wicked they are, the Lord sent the angels, and here's the wickedness totally on display. "Then the two visitors said to Lot, 'Who else do you have here? Do you have any son-in-laws, daughters, or other relatives in the city? Get them out of this place, because we are about to destroy it. The outcry against this place is so great before the Lord that he has sent us to destroy it.' Then Lot went out, spoke to his sons-in-law, who were going to marry his daughters. He said, 'Quick, get out of this place, because the Lord is about to destroy the city.' But his sons-in-law thought he was ridiculing them." Huh. All the men from young and old. Huh. So, yeah. And it's interesting. But his sons-in-law thought he was ridiculing them, jesting. So, ridiculing, jesting. So, when we take a look at the Hebrew, And he was like one taunting in the eyes of his sons-in-law. It's kind of a weird phrasing, taunting with the eyes. Well, wait a minute, eyes. Wait, why are eyes important? They're blind. So just a thought, they're blind, and maybe a deeper understanding is that, yeah, he goes out to them, they're blind. There may be some of the guys, well, not maybe. The text says there's some of the guys that are groping around his house. Lot goes out and warns these fiancés, future sons-in-law. And they're like, you're just messing with us. You're mocking us because we're blind. How much influence did Lot have on his sons-in-law? Not enough to convince them, right? Because they just thought, nope, he's jesting, he's mocking, he's ridiculing. Verse 15, at dawn, the angels hurried Lot along, saying, get going, take your wife and your daughters who are here, or else you will be destroyed when the city is judged. Go, get the heck out of here. Don't be swept away. The same swept away, that same phrase in the Hebrew, was the same word that Abraham talked about in just, so when he was talking to the Lord, it was, you know, will you sweep away the righteous with the wicked? They use the same term. And so that's why it's like sweep away. Yeah, they're using similar words in these oral narrations so that people can remember. Yeah, oh yeah, I remember. Abraham was just praying about this and warning us. So what happens? When Lot hesitated, the men grabbed his hands and the hands of his wife and two daughters because the Lord had compassion on them. So, yeah, when Lot hesitated, two angels are telling you to get the heck out of here. Why would Lot hesitate? And the angels are saying, we're here to help you. And what do they have to do? They have to literally grab the hands, grab the wrists, you know, and drag them out. That's crazy. And why are the angels there? What does it say? To destroy the city, why are they there to help out Lot and the other two? Why? What does the end of verse 16 say? We're here to help you knuckleheads, because the Lord had compassion on you. They led them away, placed them outside the city. When they had brought them outside, they said, run for your lives. Don't look behind you or stop anywhere in the valley. Escape to the mountains or you will be destroyed. Pretty clear instructions. But Lot said to them, no, please, Lord. If your servant's found favor with you and you've shown me great kindness by sparing my life, but I'm not able to escape to the mountains because this disaster will overtake me. I'm too old and I'll die. It doesn't say too old. It will overtake me and I'll die. Look, this town over there, over here is close enough to escape to. And it's just a little one. Let me go there. It's just a little place, isn't it? Then I'll survive. Very well, he replied. I will grant you this request too, and will not overthrow the town you mentioned. Run there quickly, for I cannot do anything until you arrive there. This incident explains why the town was called Zor, a little one, Zor. In Hebrew, the little one. I want you to just think about how Abraham interceded for the city. And think about how Lot, even as he's exiting, is focusing on himself. He, and this is again some of the wordplay that you've got to take a look at in Hebrew, but I'll just tell you, he acknowledges that he's been shown grace and hesed, loving kindness. He acknowledges that he's been shown that. But he feared that the evil would befall him and that he would die. And after all of this, he requested that he could just go to, you know, that little city. We don't have time to read it right now, but you can continue reading it. Please do. Don't trust anything I say. Go back and read it. The Lord brings justice. And so, I know I'm hurrying it, but what's the point of this story that clearly is still connected with the one before? And let's go to verse 27. The sun just had risen over the land as Lot reached Zoar in verse 23. Then the Lord rained down sulfur and fire on Sodom and Gomorrah. It was sent down from the sky by the Lord. So he overthrew those cities and all that region, including all the inhabitants of the city and the vegetation that grew from the ground. But Lot's wife looked back longingly and was turned to a pillar of salt. Angels warned him, don't look back. Now we have this really weird two verses thrown in here. Abraham got up early in the morning and went to the place where he had stood before the Lord and had that conversation about Sodom. He looked toward Sodom and Gomorrah and all the land of that region. As he did so, he saw the smoke rising up from the land like smoke from a furnace. So when God destroyed the cities of the region, God honored Abraham's request. He removed Lot from the midst of the destruction when he destroyed the cities Lot lived in. So God does it, does what he said he was going to do. And just so that we're really, really clear, the narration spells out the Lord remained faithful to Abraham and did what he promised. He did that. Take a look at the next little bit. I don't want to cover that next week, but take a look at the rest of this chapter, and you'll see how there was really the Lot and his two daughters that are now left. So there's only three of them left. There was clearly mental assimilation with Sodom. They moved close, and then there was mental assimilation with them. And when you assimilate with sin, it really makes it hard to shake sin. And that really, I think, is the whole point of this chapter. And because Genesis is also origins and origin story, read on the next little bit and you find out, yeah, Moab means from our father, and Ben-Ami, son of the nearest kinsman, later become the Moabites and the Ammonites. So you've got the origin story. It's a horrible, horrible passage. But the main point, when we assimilate with the world, it really makes it hard to keep the way of the Lord, especially knowing that he will judge. He'll judge sin, and he is just. So take a look at that and see if you don't see that thought in chapter 18 and 19 and even what happens at the end of 19. Next week, I want to take a look at Deja Vu chapter 20. So we'll take a look at it. And Heavenly Father, help us to not love the world or the things that are in the world, even though we live in the world and we continue day to day surrounded by temptation to not live righteously and justly as you want us to. but we know that you are righteous and just. Let us communicate this through our lives. Let us communicate to our children and to future generations who you are, and to make your name great. Amen.